Claire, and you're listening to the Mother Love Podcast, a show where we talk about the journey of parenting. This is a space where guests open their hearts, gather their courage, and tell the truth about what it means to care for these messy and delightful little ones in today's big, wide, and often overwhelming world. We talk about the pressures, the steep learning curves, and the bittersweet reality of watching our children grow. Parenting asks us to be willing to feel it all, celebration and grief, joy and anguish, fear and courage. So take a breath, let these stories wash over you, and show yourself a little love. Welcome and hello, listeners. Happy December. I am feeling the pressure of the season already sort of weighing a little extra on all I have to do. So before I even give an introduction to this next episode, I just wanted to encourage everyone to take a second and close your eyes and kind of just take a deep breath. Because life as a parent or whatever kind of situation you have in the world is already pretty overwhelming, and this season is just even more so. So take good care of yourselves. I hope listening to this episode can be sort of a little bit of a downtime and something that you're doing for you. In this final episode of our Native American Initiative series, we welcome to the show Chelsea Bellon, a mom of three and health equity community engagement specialist at the Western Montana Area Education Center. Chelsea is an Indigenous woman who offers her wisdom and insight to help identify and raise awareness of the racism that exists in education and academia, as well as health inequities in rural populations. Chelsea shares some examples in this episode of how simple cultural considerations can make a world of difference in the lives of students and patients. Chelsea mentions specifically how certain cultural considerations made a huge difference while she was under medical supervision during a time of crisis. We also talk about mental health challenges that both she and I have faced as we've navigated the intense dysregulation that accompanies a bipolar II disorder diagnosis. Sharing these pieces of our journey was really hard, but we both hope our stories will remind listeners that mental health conditions, especially when exacerbated in the perinatal period, can indeed be life-threatening and sometimes look, feel, and sound differently than you might think. If you or someone you know suffers from a mental illness and no one knows what to say or do, this episode offers very helpful guidance in what steps to take to get them support. Lastly, we are both incredibly grateful to be where we are today, and that others might find hope that healing is very possible, even when you're sure it's not. So, also just want to mention that this episode does go into stories about suicide, and so, you know, I still encourage everyone to listen. I think it's a really important episode, but depending on where you are in your day and in your world, just take that into consideration and make sure that you have space and time to care for yourself in hearing these harder pieces of our stories. So thank you, as always, for being here, and I hope that you enjoy this episode and get as much out of it as I did. So Chelsea, welcome.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Yeah, thanks so much for coming on the show today. I know that some of the things that you and I are going to talk about are pretty vulnerable and pretty personal, especially with our momming journeys. And I'm just really grateful for your courage in being able to share those things so that we can help people have a deeper understanding of what some hard to understand things look like. So, yay.
Thank you. Yeah. Thank you so much.
Yeah. So let's just start out with kind of the beginning of your mothering journey. So you now have three kiddos, and they are 7, 5, and 3.
Yep.
Yep. So you're in it now. You're in it really in a big way now, busy wise, among other things yes. that you spend your time doing. But you're also, like we talked about before, like a ways into your mothering journey, you know, being 7+ years in if we count pregnancy. So just talk to me a little bit about what it was like for you to initially become pregnant and the beginning of your mothering path.
Yeah. So I have 3 daughters. I'll start off by saying that because I think that just really amplifies my personality and how I approach life, because I was also raised by a strong, independent woman who was raised by a strong, independent woman for generations, all women. And so I take a lot of pride in that. But I became pregnant in 2014, and I found out I was pregnant after breaking up with my longtime boyfriend. Ooh. And I was in this space of, you know, okay, we grew up together. We were, you know, high school sweethearts. We went to college together, but this wasn't serving me anymore. And I needed new spaces in life to grow individually. And 2 weeks into this heartbreak, but really like fulfilling space, I found out I was pregnant. And it kind of rocked both of our worlds. I think we both experienced the acceptance of my pregnancy in a different way. We both put up walls. It was a very difficult transition. And ultimately, you know, we tried to see if we could make that work. And, you know, we did our best up until just before I went into labor. And at the time, her father just, you know, I think, you know, being scared and young and unsure of what the future looked like, I use the term bailed. He bailed. But I also, now looking back, like, he did what he had to do to protect himself. And there's no like hurt in that anymore. But I, 2 weeks before I gave birth, I was alone. I didn't have anybody. I was 6.5 hours away from my family. I had, you know, a coworker and, you know, some friends, but they were all living their lives at 23, you know, they weren't pregnant. So great. That was my intro to motherhood, of being in a space alone. And I just remember I had hired a doula at the time, just weeks before. And it was kind of a splurge in a sense. You know, I probably, looking back, could have saved that money for something else. Mm-hmm. But I just had this gut feeling that I was going to need support. And so I just remember texting my doula, and we were kind of friends at that point because I knew her in another capacity. But I remember texting her and saying, well, it's just you and me. And from that second on, it was her and I, and we planned out, we like solidified my birthing plan. I felt like I had the most support possible. It was a really beautiful, like, pick me up, I guess.
From a
very low.
I mean, we talk about the importance of doulas, and that's becoming more and more apparent in like in systems work, just in terms of that being such a supportive and preventative measure, actually, for a lot of complications that can happen. And so hearing stories like this one is like, really, I mean, if you think about what it would have been like had you not had her, had you not had anyone by your side, like, that makes me like teary, because I just feel like it's not right for anyone to be in that position, because it's such a big, huge life transition and a physical undertaking, you know, that thinking of doing it alone must have felt really scary. And I bet you felt so grateful to have her.
Yeah, I really did. And, you know, during this whole process of, you know, my ex leaving and, you know, sorting out his demons, there was such a deep hurt of abandonment, because for nearly 9 months, I thought, okay, like, I'm going to have this support going into this new phase.
Right.
You know, and I think that abandonment really came from, like, we were best friends.
Totally.
You know, we grew up together.
That's what I was going to say, is it's not like it was like a new relationship or something. Like, this had been your person for a long, long time.
Yes. And and when we broke up, it was, you know, when we originally broke up, it was very, like, very adult, you know?
Yeah.
And it was like almost like that conscious uncoupling in a way before it was like trendy, you know?
Right. Yeah.
And And so for us to go, okay, like, we're going to raise this kiddo and we're just going to, like, at least enter this phase together. Like, I, looking back, I knew 100% that I was going to be a single mom. Yeah. I had no doubt about that. But I didn't think that I was going to bring her into the world without a partner by my side.
Totally.
And that makes sense. Like, that's where that abandonment came from.
Yeah.
And so the last 2 weeks of my pregnancy was awful, because I had such a sense of grief that my body, my blood pressure was high. I started having all of these medical issues that I never had during the pregnancy.
Yeah.
And there was a really great, counselor, within the healthcare center that I was getting maternal health from. And I just remember her, it was like a day after we had split, and I was bawling. I could not stop bawling for days. And so I remember sitting there crying as they were trying to get my blood pressure to calm down, and they were using aromatherapy, and they were, you know, doing all that they could do to calm me down. And just having her as a professional in the mental health realm, sitting there talking me through creating a plan. She's the one that was like, who can be there with you? And I was like, I just hired a doula, you know?
Yeah.
So when I couldn't see the outcome or the potential, like, there was support there. So I always, her name is Melinda, and I always credit her for that as well.
Yeah. It's amazing what a difference that kind of thing can make, of just redirecting when you are so incredibly feeling so incredibly lost and hurt. And that is a physical sensation. Like, anyone who's ever been through intense grief and heartache, like, it is a physical experience, you know, like, you feel it in your chest and you feel sick to your stomach. And, like, being pregnant, that pregnant on top of all of that, I imagine, was just so hard. So being able to focus on the people you did have by your side, I can imagine how that was really helpful, for sure. Yeah. And how did labor go for you?
It was awful.
It was
the worst experience of my life.
Oh,
but that is not to say that my doula was not supportive and that that support didn't, you know, positively impact it. It was what came down to it. And people don't believe this, but I have multiple witnesses. I was in labor for a total of 62 hours before she was born.
Oh, my goodness.
So I am not sure the pronunciation. I always feel like I get it wrong, but I experienced prodromal labor. Basically, where you're in labor, your cervix, you know, it will progress a little bit and then it will literally close again and your body stops with labor. But, and so what it came down to was, you know, I woke up and I had the worst contractions. I knew that it was happening because, you know, I had lost and relost mucus plugs the last 48 hours, and all my knowledge, I knew it was, like, you know, time to go. And I will say that, you know, the last few days of my pregnancy, I was able to spend it with my ex-boyfriend's parents. They are wonderful people that have loved me most of my life, over half of my life. And when I say that I didn't have anybody, I didn't consider them as like my support, because I think when people break up, you just assume like they're supporting the other person in the relationship. Yeah. But they were lovely people. And I actually spent the last couple nights at their house because I think they were worried about me. Mm-hmm. And so it was kind of a beautiful moment of, I walked upstairs and I was in labor and I said, I need to go to the hospital. And so having his parents be a part of that was really beautiful. And so they, you know, I went in, they checked, I was a couple centimeters dilated, I was faced, but I wasn't to the point of like needing to be in the hospital just yet.
Or deserving to be. Yeah.
Yeah. Or deserving. Yeah. Yeah. And I will say, and this is the funniest part of her whole birthing story, is like, there were probably, I think it was 12 or 13 births that weekend.
Whoa.
And they were like, women were in the triage rooms, like almost ready to like push, having to be wheeled into rooms. Like, it was a full moon.
I was gonna say, was it a full moon? Yep. Isn't that wild? It's so wild.
It's so crazy. But I had three other friends that I'd met in a mommy group basically birth within the 3 days that I was laboring.
Wow.
So yeah, I went to my checkup, you know, they did a check. They said, yep, things are going to move forward. This is how it's going to go. The contractions were so intense. Hmm. It was kind of all a blur, but I do remember parts of having to go into the emergency room, and they were telling me after, like, because I couldn't get into labor and delivery right away, but it was about 8 hours after I first started going into labor. And they said that my cervix actually was closing, like it was at a one, and that they could tell by the tension, that this was going to be something that I needed to be admitted for. Mm-hmm. So they requested for me to get some sort of like relief because of how long I was in pain without being able to progress. So I do remember them giving me something. I don't want to say it was like a painkiller, but it was something to like relax my body. And I remember being able to sleep for, I think it was about an hour or two. And I woke up and they checked and I was at a four. And so we were like, okay. So I got into the bathtub. I was bouncing. I was beginning, you know, I was excited because there was progress, right?
Totally, yeah.
Couple more hours go by. They're like, what's going on? They check me. I'm at a two.
Oh my gosh. I cannot even imagine getting that news. Like,
and it was to the point where I was like requesting only the same person to check me.
Yeah.
Because I knew that, you know, people's measurements can be different. And I was just getting so frustrated. And my doula was wonderful. You know, she was with me the whole time. I can't even remember like all of the conversations we had because it felt like I didn't need to say anything. Mm-hmm. Like, she anticipated my needs. She, you know, I don't remember a lot of conversation, but I know that she was there. And I remember she was trying to lift my spirits a little bit. And I was just feeling really exhausted by the whole process. And I think this is probably 2 days into it, honestly. And she put on Disturbed and like Slipknot, like hard, heavy metal.
Yes. I've never heard of this move, but I like it.
She was like, I think it was because I was like, turn that music off, because it was like some kind of calming stuff. So she's like, let's try. And she was like, if you're frustrated, let's just like get it out of your body. Let's release it. Yes. You know? So we did some like breath work. It was, it was hilarious, but it was also like very helpful mentally.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah. And so we got to the point where, you know, I got Pitocin, which was not in my birth plan.
Yeah.
I got them breaking my water, rupturing my water, which I knew it was a possibility, but I was hoping it didn't happen.
Mm-hmm.
Then it got really fun because all these other women are giving birth and they're bringing in medical students because they're needing it because there are so many women giving birth.
Wow.
So I had like medical students in this space that was just, they couldn't believe I was in labor for that long. They'd never seen a woman's cervix close and open like as frequent as mine did over the course of almost 3 days. So it got to the point where, I mean, I was stubborn in the sense of like, my water hadn't broke, so I wasn't at a risk of infection, and her heart rate was okay. Like, mm-hmm. we were stable. And because of that, I was persistent because I wanted my birth experience.
Yeah, totally.
And it wasn't until probably going into the third day where it was like morning time when they did the, they ruptured my waters and they got the Pitocin going. And of course I started dilating even more, but more than that, the back labor came into play. And that was the most excruciating thing I've ever experienced. And so we got time to push, you know, we practiced. I didn't really understand like what that feeling was, but when my body told me, it was like game on. And so I remember feeling like, okay, I know what my body's doing now for the first time this whole journey.
Yes.
I was like, I know this cue. I could do this. So I got super pumped. I was exhausted. You know, I hadn't slept more than a couple hours over a couple of days. And so I started pushing and pushing, and everyone's being encouraging. And I will say, when I started pushing, oddly enough, my ex-partner showed up.
Wow.
He hadn't been there the whole time, but he showed up right when I started pushing. And all I remember in this room was him standing at an angle that wasn't very forgiving for me.
Yeah.
As I'm in this room, you know? And I said, get out of there and come hold my foot.
Yeah.
Like, come hold my leg. And that's all I really remember in terms of engaging with him.
Yep.
And then I do remember him being on one side and holding my leg and a doctor telling him what to do.
Yeah.
And the other thing I remember is him being really quiet.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't hear anybody's voices except for, I think it was the main nurse and my mom at the time who was in the room who had traveled. So I don't know how long I pushed for. My mom and my Nana said that it was a long time, more than I should have pushed.
Mm-hmm.
But it got to the point where they used the term sunny side up and the shoulder kind of shifted. And so they couldn't get the fetal monitor across my stomach. So they had to put it on the top of her head. They had to place something on the top of her head because she was in the canal, like she was ready to go, but her shoulder was caught. And they allowed me to keep pushing. I was completely exhausted. I remember crying through pushes, like almost sobbing through pushes.
Yeah.
And my wonderful OB, Dr. Jennifer Mayo, you know, was very kind and said, okay, we're going to just consider this not happening. You know, how would you feel if we needed to avert? And the second she said that, my daughter's heart rate, they lost it. They could not find her heart rate. And hearing a nurse say, we've lost the heart rate, and then them trying to like rush to me, I just said, let's get the C-section. So I was rushed to an emergency C-section, where they delivered her, and I was so exhausted that when they put the IV in me, to, like, you know, give me the spinal block and stuff, I stopped hurting. I passed out. I fell asleep.
Yeah.
And I remember telling myself, like, wake up, wake up. Like, yeah. She's going to be here. Wake up.
Yeah.
And I fell asleep. And the next thing I remember was waking up in this recovery area that wasn't even my room. It was like this OR recovery area.
Yeah, I've been
with
there.
With no baby, with nobody next to me.
Damn.
So waking up alone was not ideal, but after a few minutes of me literally yelling for somebody to come to me, they brought my daughter's father had her the whole time, brought her to me, and I was able to meet her for the first time.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. Wow. Yeah. There's like so much there. But this is a common, like, heartbreaking piece of stories that I hear, birth stories, like when moms are put in isolation in this recovery room and left there alone. And like that happened to me, and it's happened to a lot of moms I know. And I just, you know, providers are always asking, like, how can we do this better? Like, oh my gosh, just have a designated recovery room person who hangs out and makes sure that mom's okay and that mom knows what's going on. Like, that's the biggest thing, right? It's just feeling like you just finally got to the finish line and then you're like, what's happening? You know, it's really hard. So, and then knowing that someone else, even if it was dad, holding baby for that first, like, those first minutes of life, like, I can't talk about this without getting emotional, but like, it's great, it's best case scenario given circumstances, but like, oh my gosh, we want those moments, like, we want going from baby inside of us to baby outside of us to, like, that means baby should be on us, like, as close as possible, right? So I just have so much heart and empathy for that because I know how hard that is. And that's one area that is very specific that I think could get better in terms of care that we're providing for moms. So, that's,
It was, you know, now that, you know, my ex and I had talked about, you know, his experience during it, because I was not in tune to what he was experiencing, but he did tell me he remembered me as I was, like, trying to come in and out of things. He remembered me asking, like, is she okay? Is she okay?
Yeah.
And he went immediately to the table with the nurses and he made sure she was breathing, and he yelled, I guess, in the OR room, like, she's perfect.
Yeah.
He didn't see that I was awake. So it was good that there was, like, this, like, common understanding.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I just wish
moment,
I would have.
That moment to think of that, of him yelling that. Yeah. Like, yeah.
I just wish I was, like, aware of that.
Totally. Of course.
Because I don't remember her crying or anything.
Yeah, that's a hard loss. Those memories are a hard loss.
Yeah.
So I'm curious to know, and I hope that the next, you know, we won't tell all the stories, but my friend Kadia Key, who's been on the podcast before, talks about the experience of redemptive birth. And there's been some research around, like, after having a traumatic birth like that, you know, with your first, that you can have subsequent labor and birth experiences that kind of do feel like they redeem what we've lost. Did you have that happen?
No, unfortunately, I chose the route of C-section for the last two of my daughters, mainly because of the trauma. And I just had this feeling that if I went into trying to have a VBAC on my second, that it would put more fear into me, based on what I, you know, had already experienced. But what really solidified me kind of putting my hands up in the air and saying, I just want a healthy baby to arrive, was having hypermesis gravidarum, or HG. And I had that. I had a very minor, which I didn't know at the time, a very minor version of it with my first. I thought it was normal to get sick every single day till she was born, but it isn't. but with my second, it was severe.
Yeah.
To the point of multiple hospitalizations, IV infusions 3 times a week, couldn't get out of bed. I was on 6 medications around the clock just to function.
Yeah.
And that, you know, at that point, I knew I wasn't even going to have the strength to labor because yeah. I had lost a significant amount of weight. Mm-hmm. I was having high blood pressure issues because of the stress on my body. Mm-hmm. I was considered malnourished at the time. Yeah. So that was very traumatic. So I went the route of a C-section. It was scheduled. Mm-hmm. In the sense of like finding the beauty in it, it was my aunt was at my house, and I remember her the night before. I asked her to French braid my hair because mm-hmm. with my first, my hair didn't get done for 3 days, and I had this like yeah. mess after late yeah. braid. So I was like, I don't want to have to brush my hair for like 3 weeks to get this rat yeah, nest out.
Totally.
So she was at my house because she was going to take care of my oldest, and she French braided my hair.
Yeah.
And at this time I was, you know, I married a new partner, and, you know, my best friend, his name is AJ, and we were excited for her arrival. And the morning I woke up, and I the second I opened my eyes, I thought, could I just not throw up today? Please. Like, I just really wanted, even if it was like 4 hours,
yes.
I just wanted to like have my excitement
yeah.
be the thing that like washes away the yes. physical illness.
Yes.
That did not happen.
Yeah. but this is what I mean when I say a redemptive birth experience, right? It's not about like giving birth naturally or being able to do everything that you set yeah. out to do in your original birth plan. It's about these little yeah. moments of redemption where you knew yes. you didn't want to go through the fear that you went through before. You knew that you didn't want to comb out a nest when you were busy trying to breastfeed in your hair, like so you had it braided. You knew that going into this with peace
yes.
would mean so much to you and your family. And so that's what I mean, is like not so much the actual birth and how the route that it goes itself, but just like having the opposite experience to kind of
Yeah,
to redeem the losses that you went mm-hmm. through before. Like when baby first came out this time, I'm hopeful that you got to hold her right away and you had yeah. those yummy moments. Like those, that's more of mm-hmm. what I mean. And I'm glad. And anyway that happens for a mom, I think yeah. is really, really important. And, you know, some moms, like, they have a C-section and then they're like, okay, the way that that's going to happen for me is I'm having a home birth. And, like, that works for them. But I know a lot of moms that are like, no way I'm going through what I went through the first time. I can't do yeah. it, you know. And I, yeah. and especially you having been so sick and not able to function, mm-hmm. like, I think other moms I've talked to who've gone through severe cases of prolonged nausea like that and have been in similar situations where it was hard to even function. And you already had a kiddo that you were raising, you know, like there's just so yeah. much there. This is the prize at the end of that. And so having yeah. that go well feels very important to me. And I'm glad yeah. that was your experience.
There was a lot of things that were, I like to view it as in my control, because that was the trauma, I yeah. think, for me with my first one, was I didn't really get to control or have a say in yeah. what my body was doing.
Right.
And
exactly.
so with the second one, I did have that. And more than anything, like I look back on my second pregnancy and I kind of blocked it out. Probably one reason, because it was, you know, traumatizing, but two, because it really did not matter, because I had the most amazing support from my husband.
Yeah.
And our friends that we've built that have children, and people were learning about the condition that had never heard about it just to support me. Yes. So I went from having this lonely experience to just being wrapped in love.
Yeah, totally. And that's such an important lesson. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm so glad.
I do think that that was, you know, the best outcome for that situation. So yeah. I did get to see her right away. You know, I got to love on her, and she came out with white platinum blonde hair, which shocked both my husband and I, but it just goes to show she was kind of like our shocking kiddo to begin with, the way she was, you know, born. And
Oh, that's so good. Okay. Well, I feel like there's so much there in terms of just understanding. It's like once you understand these stories that are so, they're such pivotal moments in a human's life, but a mom's life especially, like having known that you got through all of those things in ways that you did, and that you were able to embrace support and learn how important that is, and having your village, right? Like these, I imagine, are all part of your character now, like deeply embedded in you. And I want to talk about how that has trickled into the work that you do. But before we go there, I want to talk about something that you and I both have in common, which has to do with our mood disorders that we experienced in the perinatal period, because I think that's yet another thing that can kind of wake you up to the reality of what is sometimes the experience of moms and families that then can lead you to want to do advocacy work and want to do work in healthcare and want to like really spread awareness about these things. So let's go ahead and go into that area, and then we'll move more into like how that now impacts your professional life.
So, you know, to give a very brief snapshot, after each of my first two, there was some mood disorder issues. With my first, there was this high that I was on after her birth. And then my second, I fell into a really, really, you know, deep depression for a while. And I was able to get medication and, you know, manage it for a while and got off the medication. And, you know, I experienced postpartum depression, but I also found my way out of it. But after my third child, which was a really great pregnancy and a great experience with her birth too, so I was kind of like really happy going into knowing this is our final baby. I got a really decent pregnancy experience, even though I had minor HG. I was able to eat the foods I liked. It was just a beautiful like rounding to closing the chapter of giving birth and creating babies in my body. But, you know, shortly after, about a year, I was again on medication, trying to manage it, the postpartum. It reared its head about 3 months postpartum. It didn't happen gradually. It hit me hard. And so I got, you know, I continued with medication. I grew up in a way traditionally that, you know, Western medication and pharmaceuticals just were not the way. But I also lived in a world of, you know, more Western beliefs now since I left home. And I knew the benefit of, you know, medication for mental health. And so I was comfortable taking these medications. And then there was a point where I thought, okay, I'm better. You know, I had a couple good weeks. I said, okay, I'm good. Like, I feel really good. I'm going to, you know, slowly, you know, get off of this. I did it the right way. I did it with my doctor. You know, it was an okay experience. About probably 6 months later, I still was struggling up and down, but I was also like taking more things on with work. I was, you know, trying to just like experience this new phase of life of like just moving forward, right?
Yeah.
Like,
yep.
I think when I was in this maternity bubble or this pregnancy bubble, I kind of just did the bare minimum in everything in life.
Yep.
But afterwards, I was like, I'm going to be on all of these committees. I'm going to do all the things. I'm going to spend all the time play dates with my kids. And it was not this summer, but the previous summer. So, is that 2022?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, 2022. Wow. Not that long ago. Summertime in Montana, most beautiful time of the year. And my memory with it just is, it's a little bit different than how like my husband experienced it, which is normal. But our nanny at the time lived next door to us, which was really nice. I would drop the kids off with her, all three kids, and I would stay in bed until I had to pick them up, and I would sleep. We didn't eat. I didn't shower. I was doing my best to make myself seem okay when my husband got home from work.
Yeah.
But then after probably a week of doing that, it, like trying to be okay around him when he got home, once he got home, I asked him if I could go lay down.
Mm-hmm.
And I do remember seeing his sense of worry, but then I remember having this thought of like, oh my gosh, just let me sleep. You're making it a bigger deal, you know, like very dismissive. Right.
Yeah.
Almost annoyed that he would be concerned.
Right.
And so it went on. I was about just past 2 weeks of doing this, and my husband came home from work on lunch, and he sat down, and this was like the end of May, so maybe, you know, late spring, but he sat down on the bed where I was sleeping. He had not come home like that early before ever. And he said, I'm really worried about you. I can't stop thinking about you at work. Like, you know, do you want me to nap with you? Do you want me to get a shower started for you? Like, you know, how can I help you? And I just kept telling him, I'm just tired.
And
I could sense in his voice, like, you've been sleeping for, you know, weeks. Like, this is not tired. And so he just expressed, I don't remember everything he said, but he basically expressed like, I am really worried about you. I do think we should, you know, get you to talk to someone, you know, have you talked to your therapist? Like, who can I reach out to for you? And again, kind of dismissed him, kind of got annoyed. And he went back to work, and it was probably an hour after that, all of a sudden, this like deep, deep sense of like sadness came over me, because I was numb this whole time.
Yeah.
You know, but this huge sense of just sadness hit me, and I just couldn't stop crying.
Yeah.
And I didn't understand why I was crying. Yeah. And I felt annoyed with myself.
Yeah.
For crying.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I, during this 2 weeks, there were thoughts, right?
Yeah. Right.
There were ideas. Mm-hmm. There were ideas of how a plan could take place.
Yeah.
Pretty detailed.
Yeah.
For someone who was pretty numb, I thought about some very scary things.
Yeah.
And so I was crying, and I remember looking into our closet and standing in front of the closet and turning around and grabbing my phone and calling him. And I don't think my husband's phone rang but once, and he answered, and I asked him to come get the guns.
Yeah.
Out of the house.
Yeah.
And he was here. I don't know how long it took him to get here, but I remember him telling me on the phone, go to the porch, go sit on the porch.
Yeah. Yep.
Go to the porch. Tell me if you're on the porch. And so I remember like standing on the porch. He didn't get off the phone with me. He stayed on the phone with me.
Yeah.
And he grabbed the guns. He had them, I think he like locked them in the trunk or something. And then he grabbed my purse and he grabbed my hand. Mm-hmm. And he got me in the car.
Yeah.
And he drove me to St. Pat's Hospital.
Yeah. Yeah. Those are all the right things to do, right?
Yeah.
On his end and on your end, right? Yep. I mean, this is when people wonder what a depressive episode looks like and they don't know and they can't fathom what that's like. It is, and I don't think that I understood until it was happening to me.
Yeah.
That it's not as obvious as you would think. Like these thoughts that can creep in and this desire that you have, it's subtle, like until it's not. For me, it was that way. It was a lot more like disorienting than it was like a direct mission. It was like sort of like a slippery slope. And I'm grateful for you sharing that in like in detail, because I do think there's a misunderstanding of what those moments look like. And I think it's really important for people to understand the disorientation piece, really. Like you need someone to be on the phone with you, know that they're on their way, be that direct with you. And then the thing you need to hear is like, okay, now we're going to get help. Like now.
Yeah.
You know, and so I think that it's really important to talk about that because those are crucial minutes.
And I don't even think I asked him like where we were going. I just like followed his lead.
Yeah.
And I remember going down, if you're familiar with Missoula, down Orange Street. Uh-huh. And I just, the second we kind of hit that area, I knew where we were going. Mm-hmm. I've done a lot of work, since then, but just to kind of go back to that moment, I think what really triggered that, like that snap of like standing in front of the closet and kind of considering this, this potential outcome was, when I was sitting there crying, I truly did not understand what I was crying about. And then that negative self-talk that I think a lot of folks with depression or bipolar experience became. And then it went quickly from, gosh, stop crying, Chelsea. Like, there's no reason to cry, to you're just stressing out your husband. You are just being a pain.
Totally.
You're being a pain in the ass.
The burden thoughts. Yep.
And then I thought, my kids deserve somebody who's going to be able to play with them. You know, my kids and my family don't deserve to have to worry about me. Why do they need to worry about me? And in a second, like all of these thoughts came in, and that's what brought me to stand in that closet. Yes, truly.
There it is. I totally, completely relate to that. Because at that time when those thoughts come in and take over, it really truly is convincing that this is an act of love for your family, right? That this is, that this is like hard, like a lot of things as a mom. But yeah, I think that those thoughts, and this is really hard for me to say, but when I've come to a place in my understanding and through what I've been through in those moments, and like, I don't even talk about this on the show very much, but like, I've had those thoughts again and again, and that, and I still struggle with it, not as much as I have in the past. Mm-hmm. But when I read headlines about moms who do go through with that and they do die by suicide. Like, mm-hmm. I can understand the reasoning yeah. that brought them there. And I don't yeah. have any judgment because, like, I know that soundtrack. Like, I know how convincing that can be. And I know that as a mom, when you feel like you're doing something, even if it's destructive or self-sacrificing, that's a confusing place to be because you think, okay, they are better off without me, like truly. And so right. I'm doing everyone a service by removing right. myself from their lives. And there've right. been so many times where I've wished, and at this point, this struggle looks more like this to me. I've wished I could just like subtract myself like from the mm-hmm. equation without anyone like having had any memory of me ever existing, like so that yeah. it's not their loss. They're not having a loss. It's more just like, okay, I'm no longer around to be bringing everyone down or to be having a burden. And I'm at a place yeah. now where I'm not sick. I'm doing well and I'm recovered from a lot mm-hmm. of those things that were such a dominant part of my life for so many years. But I remember them well, and they still have like hauntings of those kinds of thoughts. And it's just so painful and so scary. And I think that I too, you know, have a bipolar 2 diagnosis, and we talk about, you and I have talked about, and it's well known now, not by everyone, but in like research land and in medical professional land, that bipolar symptoms can be highly exacerbated during the perinatal period for a variety yes. of reasons. That was something I didn't know. I didn't even know that I was struggling with that mood disorder. Mm-hmm. And so I do think it's a really tricky one to navigate, because when you do start to feel better, like you, like a classic actual mm-hmm. symptom of bipolar is that people stop taking their medications because mm-hmm. they think they're yep. doing better. Like, of course, that makes yep. perfect sense, right? If you're in a better place and you're not dipped down into a deep depressive episode, like even baseline feels really good, because the darkness and heaviness yeah. of being in an episode that is super depressive. And like you said, like to where you can't even stay awake. You're so
yeah.
down and numb. Mm-hmm. So I think that it's just important to talk about all of this because it's so misunderstood and there's so much stigma still. And moms who are going through this like really, really need support.
Yeah.
And in my experience, yeah. medication. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that something that I didn't know until, you know, I received help was I knew I had depression, and I also knew I had anxiety, right? Mm-hmm. And I don't think people realize that, you know, anxiety and the spectrum of anxiety, you know, with compounded, you know, complex depression or, you know, whatever that depression is, it really is like some of the bigger indicators of mood disorders. Right. I viewed anxiety, you know, in a different way, even though I truly knew that the level of anxiety I had was not normal.
Yeah.
You know, it was not normal. After my second daughter was born, this was even before I, you know, got help and went to the hospital. I know this sounds, you know, wild, but something in my brain 110% convinced me that my daughter as an infant was going to die.
Mm-hmm.
And my brain told me, the only way you can prepare for this is to have everything figured out before it happens.
Yeah.
Like nobody, like my daughter was healthy. There was no, you know, but it was almost like I had this paranoia.
Yeah.
And I didn't want to say that to anybody. And I didn't tell anybody until after I received help years later, when I realized that was not normal.
Right.
You know, like, there's anxiety, there's worry, and then there's paranoia.
Yeah.
You know, so I did everything under the sun, including like, I don't even like saying this, but like looking up the cost of like a casket, mm-hmm. you know, figuring out the process of what happens at a funeral home for an infant, like just wild things that kept me up late at night.
Yeah. Oh, Chelsea, that's so hard.
And I was just convinced of it. And it's so wild to think about it now, because mm-hmm. it was just this nonchalant thing that I just knew was going to happen. I needed to prepare for. And now I'm like, oh, like, I really wish you would have told somebody that.
Right.
Like, you know, totally. Somebody trusted. I didn't even tell my husband.
Yeah. Of course. I mean, of course not. Like now we know it's important to talk about those things, but when you're going through that, like, you can't even believe that you're, you know, it's, but like, it makes sense to you in that moment. Like, it's the only thing that makes sense is to do all the legwork. And that's what's crazy about like brains and thoughts, right? Is like, that can hijack mm-hmm. your life. And, mm-hmm. and then there it is. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
It was pretty wild, but
yeah. Yeah. And then how does life look? Oh, and then we did talk about, you know, let's go back and talk about what happened once you did arrive at the hospital, and what did the next part of healing look like for you?
Yeah. So, you know, to keep it pretty, there was a lot. I was in the hospital for 6.5 days, and I do have to give credit to the ER at St. Pat's, because I had the best care that I think I could have experienced. You know, it was during COVID, so mm-hmm. I couldn't have anybody come in with me. I got put into a safe room. I remember just sleeping in the safe room and having two people come in and evaluate me. I don't remember those conversations, but the last conversation was, I think, the psychiatrist holding my hand, trying to look me in my eye and ask me, like, do you want to get checked in?
Yeah.
And I remember saying, call my husband. I'll do what my husband wants.
Yeah.
Because I didn't have it in me to make a decision. But totally. I knew I needed to be there.
Yeah.
So yeah, I spent 6.5 days at the adult psychiatric ward. And I went in with every stereotype under the sun. Grippy socks, bars on windows, mm-hmm. you know, med checks, open door policy, like all of these things that you hear negative things about, awful food, you know, mm-hmm. like all of this. And I remember sleeping the first couple of days, kind of just, they started me on new medication and trying to get me regulated. And so during that period of being regulated, you know, they did allow me to sleep, but once they had some medicine in me, they kind of required me to stay awake during certain hours.
Uh-huh.
I experienced wonderful care in the term of like group settings, individual therapy. You know, I remember talking to the psychiatrist and saying out loud for the first time the different plans that I had in mm-hmm. mind of how mm-hmm. I was going to take my life.
Mm-hmm.
And just the grace.
Yeah.
Like, just absolute grace and understanding and no judgment.
Yeah.
Because even though I was in this space with, you know, over the course of 6 days, like different numbers of people, I still felt like I was the only one experiencing it.
For sure. You know?
Like, I was in a psych ward with probably folks that were struggling with far more challenging situations, but I still felt like nobody else is going to understand this.
Yep. Well, I think it comes back to that self-hatred that comes in when those plans are formulating and when you're having those kinds of ideas, like the amount that you're that people can beat themselves up when they're having that. That's why it's so soothing when someone does have grace for you. Yeah. When you finally express what's been going on, like while you've been expressing it to yourself in your mind over and over, and what you've been is just berated and put down and judged, like self-judgment, you know, it does feel like that you become convinced that if you say those things out loud, that's also what's going to come back at you. And that is like an unbearable thought of having that experience, right? So when you're met with grace and compassion and understanding, like it feels like the opposite of what you'd expect. And it's so crucial.
Yeah, it was a huge, there were a lot of moments looking back on it where I kind of was surprised, but really obviously thankful for those surprises. And I think those surprises were like, I took them as confirmations that I needed to be there. Yeah. One of the first things, the first person that like came into my room after I arrived, and I arrived late at night, was a Native man and a pastor or a chaplain. And this Native man came in, I don't know his name or his title, and he gave me braided sweetgrass.
Yeah.
And I think just that first experience of like, I never told anybody that I was Native. I mean, obviously it's in my file, you know,
right.
But like, I didn't request that.
Yeah.
So to have that like be present, and you know, the first moments of being in that space was really crucial. Because I felt like, okay, they see my culture, they understand that I need this component to get better. And throughout the whole stay, you know, there were, you know, conversations around, what are your cultural, like, protective things that you can do? It wasn't just Western-based.
Yeah.
And I have to, like, give 100% credit to those providers in that space.
Yes.
You know? Like, I don't think that that's a requirement for the hospital itself, right? It's the heart of those providers.
Yeah.
Saying, okay, I see that you're Native American. I see that you, you know, are struggling. I see that Western care is not something you were raised around. That
right.
The psych ward is not just, you know, society's stereotypes, but there's a fear-based component because of your culture.
Yes.
So all of those little tiny moments, I was like, I just kept thinking, I can do this. Like, I can take what they're teaching me. I can put it to use in any kind of compartment that I have, you know, or my capability. And, you know, it was like 6 days seems like such a short time, but when you're in there, it did not feel like a short time.
Yeah.
So when I say half of my time, I like gave my all into getting better. That's 3 days, right? But you're around the clock. You're working on yourself. You're in groups.
And that's all you're supposed to be doing, right? There isn't a bunch of guilt about all the things that are being left undone while you're focusing on healing. And I think that's a big part of it. Yeah.
Yep. So I always say like, I had a great experience in the psych ward, and people are like, what? I'm like, yeah. And you know, I do remember my husband coming and visiting the last couple days, and he was worried, and he would show up, and I'd be working on puzzles.
Yeah.
And he was like, I've never seen you do a puzzle in your whole life. So working on puzzles and being, you know, I was taking all of these practices of mindfulness and like implementing them throughout the day, and really like exercising this new muscle of like self-awareness, which was really empowering. And then, you know, when we think about the down parts of being, you know, in the psych ward and the really tough parts, it really was all centered around my kids.
Yeah, you know? I'm sure.
Like I requested my husband, I would call him every night, but I would request that he not put the kids on the phone.
Yeah, totally.
Because I knew that that would break me.
Yes.
I knew I could not do that. That
yeah.
Hearing them would probably put me back 10 steps.
Yep, totally.
So my kids went 6 days without me, and they'd never gone a day without me.
Yeah.
You know, I worked from home. It was COVID. Yeah. We hadn't been apart in over a year.
Yeah.
So that was really difficult. And then working through those conversations of like, why do you feel your kids would be better off without you?
Yes.
That was the hardest thing to work through. And not even like reframe or like change, but really accept the fact that those are thoughts that I have pretty frequently and that I might have going forward.
Yeah.
Just that acceptance because I am medicated.
Piece is really huge. Yeah.
Yeah. Just because I'm medicated and, you know, and regulated is what I call it. You know, some people say with bipolar too, like you're in recovery or whatnot, but I call it, I'm regulated when I'm on my medication and I'm, you know, doing what I need to do. But doing all of those things, I can still have those moments of, gosh, my family deserves so much better for me.
Yeah.
But it's like how I respond to that is what makes the biggest difference.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. Thank you for sharing all of that.
Yeah.
I feel like there are so many things that I want to like go back and talk about, but then we'll be here all day. So I'm just grateful. I'm just grateful that you shared that. And I do want to, I guess just to follow and kind of close that piece of our conversation. Can you talk about like now you're, you know, months later, a year, more than a year later?
Yeah, a little over a year.
Since that having happened and like, how does life look differently today in terms of how you're able to just be who you are, the mom that you are today, and just all the freaking work that you're doing? Like it's a lot, and, you know. And I'd love for you just to talk about what life looks like today in contrast to that.
Yeah. So I've got three great kiddos. And I'm more present. I think I'm more mindful of, you know, if I am struggling as a mom, like, how can I help myself without the guilt, you know? So instead of going to, oh my gosh, I need to be better. I need to stop raising my voice. Or I need to stop, you know, approaching this subject with such, you know, hostility. It's more of a gentle understanding that I'm stressed, I have anxiety, I'm maybe touched out, or I, you know, sensory overload. Like, so I'm more gentle with myself. I'm in graduate school, and if you would have told me even a few weeks before I went into my depressive episode that I would go to grad school, I would tell you that you were just full of it. Like,
so I
would have laughed in your face. Like,
totally.
Grad school has never been on my mind. Like, it was never something I strived for or saw myself doing, but things change. Life happens. That's a whole nother thing we could go into, but I'm 2 weeks away from finishing my first semester in grad school. Like Amy, Dr. Stiffarm, I'm at UND and I'm in the Masters of Public Health and Indigenous Health. And that has given me a really great sense of like confirmation of my identity. And it allows my culture and the way I was brought up to really like come out in the work that I feel is important. And with my bipolar too, I feel regulated. I still struggle. I've done a lot of education in terms of understanding what hypomania is and rapid cycling. And I do really just approach my bipolar as, I mean, I am bipolar, right?
Yeah.
Like, that is who I am, and that's okay. Mm-hmm. That is, I'm never going to not be bipolar.
Yeah.
And I don't think people realize that. Just like you said, like, we can't just stop the medication. I had the psychiatrist in the psych ward tell me, you will do significantly more damage if you stop your medication.
Yeah.
Like, abruptly, you know?
Yeah.
So, yeah, right. I just, right now I'm regulated. When I feel a cycle coming on or an episode coming on, I have the tools that I didn't even know existed.
Yeah.
And more than anything, which I would love to just encourage anybody who's listening or who comes in, you know, conversation with any of us that do have bipolar, is to highlight the importance of a safety plan. Mm-hmm. And safety network. That was something that I was taught in the psych ward, and I still to this day have an up-to-date safety plan of who I call, who I text, and each person on that safety plan knows who else is on the safety plan. And so it is this all-encompassing bubble of people who know about my diagnosis, who know about my history, who can contact professionals quickly, who, you know, are in my area. And I thankfully have not had to reach out to my safety plan and instill that, but I know it's there. And
it's there.
It is so, so helpful.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yep. So that's kind of where I am today.
Yeah. I know. It makes me just I don't know. This one's close to home for me, obviously, for so many reasons, but it makes me cry and be like, I'm emotional because I just know what a hopeless place that can be when you're in the throes of it. And sometimes I have had to say to my friends and family members, I'm so out of hope that if there's any hope, I need you to hold on to hope for me right now. I can't access it. I can't pray. I can't think about the future. I'm convinced that there's no future and no hope. So I need you to hold on to that for me. And thinking about just when we think about people who are further along on the path than we are, that is where we find hope, is okay, now Chelsea's in grad school. I think it's understanding, especially as a bipolar person who sees the world as all or nothing, that's part of it, right? Is knowing that you are doing all these incredible things, you're in grad school, you have 3 kids, you're momming, you're all you're doing so much and it's so incredible, and you struggle still. And you have people who rally around you still because you are bipolar and you were created this way. And I think that that's such an important consideration, because it feels like when a depressive episode especially comes on, manic episodes are an interesting thing to even consider because the productivity and all of that is so praised in our culture. We don't have time to go there, but when a depressive episode is going on, which is much more hard to fit into daily life, it feels like such a backslide, and it feels like such a failure, because you're I thought I was better. I thought I was doing better. And now look, this is happening again. And it can really become this okay, well, I guess everything I've done up until this point doesn't even matter anymore. That's a thought for me that can come easily in. And so now I have to confront that too and be actually, healing isn't linear. We hear this all the time, right? That it does matter, all the work we've done to get better. And it does mean that this won't consume me and completely take over my life because I have these tools, but it's hard to get there. And so I think that the hope lies in many things, but in looking to those who have been able to find the tools and get the help that they need, and know that that's possible for anyone who's struggling, not just with bipolar, but with any mood disorder or any illness, really. So and let's go into just a little more detail, and then we'll try to wrap up soon because because we have to. Tell me what it's been like to be doing the work that you're doing and to work with one of my favorite humans in the whole world, Dr. Amy Stepharm. Like, she hates being praised, which is so that makes it one of my favorite things to do. Tell me what it's been like to do the work you're doing and to work with Amy and just to be working in this Indigenous advocacy space.
Yeah, so my official role is a health equity and community engagement specialist with Western Montana AHEC. And so it's the Area Health Education Center. And I've been in this role for a year and a half, but I've been in the realm of public health for years. But I was in the realm of public health in an administrative side. Or program implementation. So I was supporting all those on the ground doing the research and doing the community, gatherings of information sharing. And, a year and a half ago, I saw this opportunity of doing something that was a little bit more meaningful, that allowed me to be that person on the ground and to value my, beliefs and my culture. And to let that be a part of me instead of stifling that within, say, Western academia, And so that's kind of the reason I went that route. But right now, Dr. Stepharm, you and I might have to fight over who's the biggest fan, because I joke with her all the time and say that I'm fangirling over everything that she does. And so to have her be willing to, in a sense, be this mentor to me, I'll probably get emotional.
I know. Yeah.
But yeah. Because when I started this graduate program and when I started this position, I really saw it had to do with COVID, honestly. I saw the way the Native communities, tribal communities, just rallied. And it's not something I'm not accustomed to. I know how communities come together. But when there was a worldwide pandemic, they were protecting themselves, they were protecting their elders, their children. They were the highest rated immunized population, in the nation. They were grassroots organizations, community building, were getting supplies, they were creating, medicinal teas to combat COVID. Mm-hmm. I mean, it wasn't easy work, but they had the knowledge and they had the solutions. And so seeing that, that's something that clicked in my brain where I said, I want to support that. I want to do that, but I want to support that in any tribal community or tribal nation. I don't know what it looks like. They're going to tell me what that looks like, because I am not a member of a Montana tribe. I am a member of the Yankton Sioux tribe, but I was born and raised in the Colville Confederated Tribes Reservation in the Sampoil Valley. And so I have this history of not technically being on my homeland, but having heart ties and community ties to other tribal communities. So going in this direction, I didn't know what my niche or my specialty was going to be until I got my beautiful bipolar diagnosis, until I saw how my experience, not even just within maternal healthcare timeline, but overall healthcare experience as a little res kid growing up with IHS, seeing all of that, reflecting on all of that, and asking myself, how can I support Western trained providers to do better, to be better?
Yeah. Yep.
And then the ultimate goal is, to reduce this trauma and the hardships and the racism and discrimination that, our relatives are experiencing. That's kind of what brought me to where I am. And then, maternal healthcare has always been important to me. And so, you know, I reached out to Dr. Stiffarm, hoping and praying that she would, you know, meet with me. And that's when we got to talk about her toolkit. She was still finishing up her doctoral degree. And I was able to, like, review that toolkit. And that toolkit is gold. And I just thought, okay, this is it. Like, this is exactly it. I'm so grateful that there's someone leading this work. Like, I just want to soak in all the knowledge. And so I don't want to, like, share out too much, but we're working on some really cool projects that'll come to fruition soon. Yes. And I just couldn't be more thankful to have that. And being able to work with Healthy Mothers, Healthy Babies, that's coming up too. And so having that, you know, partnership will be happening very soon. And yeah, I just feel like there's this sense of not just purpose, but like, there's this beauty now that came from my bipolar diagnosis.
Yeah.
Like, I didn't have to go through all of that just to have this diagnosis. You know, like, I can do something with it, even if it's not specifically focused on a mood disorder project. Yes. If I can just relate to other mothers, like, that's it. That's all I want. So
yeah,
there's this beautiful, it hasn't come full circle, or maybe it has, and it'll continue to come full circle, but there is this beautiful, like, sigh of, this is what I'm supposed to do.
Yeah, it's so incredible. And I think it's so beautiful to think that there are, like, actual, this thing about lived experience, right, is that it brings any concept that we might have of, like, how the cultural safety toolkit is important or why it matters or whatever. But when you have the experience of, like, being where you were and it's late at night, and you're somewhat scared, and someone shows up with braided sweetgrass, and, like, that, you, like, you then know it in your cells and in your bones, the difference that that makes for people, right?
Yeah.
And so it's going back to those moments of, like, I don't just understand that this is important on an academic or cerebral or intellectual level. Like, I know this is important on, like, a human survival level.
Yeah.
And that, I think, is where the beautiful mashup of, like, everything you've gone through and everything that is a need in the healthcare community, like, those come together in a way that is different than how it could be presented in any sort of, like, policy or system or, like, requirement or box to check. Like, this is, like, no, this matters because it saved my life in a way,
right.
You know? And so I love that so much. And I don't think you win with fangirling Amy Stiffarm, but I think we're coming from, like, slightly different levels. But yeah, I mean, I've heard her say about other leaders in this area and in research that has to do with maternal indigenous health. Like, I've heard her say, like, that they've led the way for her, and that there's this beautiful kind of, like, others paving the way. And this work is new. It's novel, which is hard to understand that that could be true. But the women that I've met that are leading this work are just coming from such an incredibly heart-filled, passionate space that it doesn't surprise me that the work that's being produced to address these things is being produced in a completely new way, like time and time again. It's based on different things, and it's based on new methods, and it's based on a deeper understanding and a wider perspective. And it's just so beautiful in that way. And I feel like I learn every single day, you know, here at Healthy Mothers, Healthy Babies, and just speaking with people. And so it's really been incredible in that way. Okay. We have to wrap up.
I know.
And I want to say too, that in these particular, like, we talk a lot about show notes, and I don't know if listeners take the time to scroll down and see what's shared, but I, in this particular show, like, between you and I, Chelsea, like I'd love us to list some of the things that have been most helpful for us throughout our journeys, you know, like going through a traumatic birth, you know, becoming a mom, having struggles in those early days, what it's like to have bipolar, how moms are more at risk, you know, in these certain ways. Like we'll just list out a strong, healthy list of what has helped us, some of the tools you've found. And even some of the like literature that I was given about people who have bipolar, who've been, you know, like, I don't know if you know Kay Redfield Jamison, but her books that she's written about like famous people who've been able to really embrace this, you know, quote unquote disorder slash way of life. Like, and it has actually been really it's made them successful in unique ways. Just learning about that was such a relief to me. And so we'll just list out a lot of things that have been helpful for both of us and hope that anyone who's listening who wants to know more can know more about everything we talked about. So thank you so much.
Thank you. I didn't know what we would do and talk about today. And I think that the universe works in a way that, you know, continuously reminds us of what we need to keep, you know, upfront in our minds and our hearts. And this is one of them. So I appreciate you listening and hearing me cry and
being crying with you.
Yeah.
Good. Well, thank you so much. And we just appreciate that you could come on.
Yeah, thank you.
Mother Love is hosted by Healthy Mothers, Healthy Babies, the Montana Coalition, a nonprofit organization dedicated to the health and well-being of families who are expecting or raising little ones. Opinions and views expressed in these interviews do not necessarily represent the views of HMHB as an organization. We sincerely value the lived experiences shared on Mother Love, and we understand that not everyone will agree with or relate to all of what is shared. Mother Love exists to help our guests and listeners honor and embrace their own stories and experiences. If the content in this episode has caused you concern or distress, please reach out to someone you trust for support. Speaking up about our struggles is half the battle, sometimes more than half. And there are many providers who can and want to help. Visit our statewide online resource guide at www.hmhb-lifts.org to help you find resources in your area.
Thank you to our incredible editor and producer, Brooke Boone Miller, for sharing her gifts with us. She's a mom and she gets it, and for that we are so grateful.